Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, and welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and today we're going to explore the world of behavioral economics with a most fascinating individual, a pioneer in the field, the author of two best-selling books on the subject, Dan Ariely. Before we begin, let's discuss what behavioral economics is, how it's different from traditional economics, and why it gives us better insights into what the future may hold than traditional economics. All of economics is meant to be about people's behavior. Traditional economics imagines a world populated by calculating unemotional maximizers and assumes that people are perfectly rational and that people have unlimited information processing power at all times. Clearly, these are not good assumptions, but nonetheless, they undergird the entire framework of traditional economics. Further, the standard economic framework rules out or conveniently ignores virtually all the behavior studied by cognitive and social psychologists. This framework is defended by some who claim that the model is right, or at least right enough, while others simply argue that the standard model is easier to formalize, and therefore more relevant from a practical standpoint. Behavioral economics blossomed from the realization that neither point of view was correct. Here to tell us about behavioral economics again is Dan Ariely. Welcome, Dan. And can you begin by telling us about behavioral economics and how it differs from traditional economics?
You know, behavioral economics is a field that looks at economics without assuming that people are rational. And sometimes we find that people are behaving quite rationally, right? So those projects don't seem to count as behavioral economics. But from my perspective, everything I do is behavioral economics because everything I do is empirical without preconceived notions about what needs to be the result, so what I'm expecting to see.
That separates you from economics, as I understand it. A lot of economics I consider to be, it doesn't have a mechanism for testing quite routinely. They have a lot of theories. They've got a lot of math. So how do you interact with the regular economics department? Is there a close relationship, a growing relationship?
It's kind of an interesting thing. So standard economics starts from axiomatic assumptions,
and then
like rationality, like the people have perfect knowledge about their preferences. They can compute everything. They have an infinite horizon. The machinery that is running our brain is infinite in capacity. And then they come out with predictions about what will happen. And even when they do empirical stuff, they use the fact that they find some evidence for the theory as if the theory holds 100%. Mm-hmm. So think about something like Freakonomics, Steve Levitt. So he has some really nice papers. One of them is showing that you thought that real estate agents care about you. No, it turns out they're influenced by their own incentives. Now, it's absolutely true that they're influenced by their own incentives, but it doesn't mean that they're only influenced by their own incentive. That's actually a big difference. So to say that there's some evidence that they're influenced by the economic forces doesn't mean that they're perfectly rational and doesn't mean that they're not influenced by other things as well. So in some sense, if you think about Freakonomics and kind of our work, they look maybe at the half full part of the glass and we look at the half empty part of the glass. The difference is that by looking at the half-full part of the glass, economists assume that the glass is perfectly full, and we don't assume that way. In terms of the relationship with economics, you know, I actually like economics. I like standard economics. I think it's a beautiful discipline with purity and elegance and lots of insights. And in some sense, I don't want to pollute it. I think economists should do what economists do well, which is to think about very simplified, elegant models that are not close to reality and not good descriptions of reality, but they're interesting and insightful. My problem is not so much with economics, is when we come to apply it. So imagine that economists did what they were doing, and they would say, you know what? Here's a theory. I don't know how much it explains of reality, but we can test it out. And that's where I think economists have gone wrong, is that they fall in love with their theory so much that they say not only is this a theory that is interesting, it actually is a perfect description of reality, mm-hmm. and you don't need anything else in the world to understand what's going on. Therefore, you can apply it to create tax policy and to create transportation regulations and whatever mm-hmm. you want. And that's actually where I would like to see change. So I would like economists to keep on studying what they're doing, psychologists to keep on studying what they're doing, sociologists, anthropologists, philosophers. And when we come to the marketplace, and when we come to implement something, I want us to get together and say, okay, so how should we do it? Think about something like educational policy. Mm-hmm. We need to decide how to incentivize teachers and students and principals and districts and how to bus people and what taxation to use and so on. We need mechanisms. It would be nice if we all got together, we all came up with our own ideas of what needs to be done, and then we ran some experiment to see who actually wins, who has a better theory. So that would be kind of my model of a good reality, where everybody is studying the core discipline, and we only come together for applied stuff, mm-hmm. which is the important stuff, really.
Right, so give us an example of how you could study something where we're going to take an experiment, we're going to put some people in a situation, and we're going to be able to study this in some way in a repeatable fashion. I mean, is this really possible?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, actually, experiments are very easy to do, and the reality is that because people behave quite similar to each other, we don't even need very big numbers. So, you know, let's say we did an experiment on what color we see the wall behind you. We wouldn't need many people, right? It could be you and me, and the agreement will be 100%, and we could do it 10 times, and we will find out that there's no variance. As things become more and more different across people, we need more and more people to try and get a good estimate of the variance. And the many of the experiments that we do on basic decision-making, the variance is actually quite low. It really looks very much like visual illusions and perceptions. People basically have very, very similar opinions. So we don't even need that big numbers. So think about something like what's called hyperbolic discounting. Imagine I asked you a following question. I say, Chris, what would you rather have? A half a box of chocolate right now or a full box of chocolate in a week? Half a box of chocolate now, full box in a week.
I'll take the full box in a week.
Okay, that's very good. Turns out that about 20% of the people take the one in a week, and most people take the half a box of chocolate now. And by the way, if we had the half a box of chocolate actually here, mm-hmm. and we were not after dinner, but before dinner, you would probably take the half a box of chocolate. So most people in this situation say, give me the half a box of chocolate immediately. I don't want to wait another week for another half a box of chocolate. That's what 80% of the people say. But if I say, what about if I push those choices to the future? And I say, Chris, what would you like to have? A half a box of chocolate in a year or a full box of chocolate in a year and a week? Now realize it's the same decision. It's a decision, mm-hmm. would it be worthwhile for you to wait another week for another half a box of chocolate? And now 100% of the people say they'll wait. Mm-hmm. Right? So basically what we have is a flip from 80% of the people saying, I want the quick, sooner, smaller reward, to mm-hmm. 100% of the people say, I want the later reward when you push it to the future. Mm-hmm. Right? And this is you're a very unusual person in the fact that you said you'll wait another week for another half a box of chocolate. But vast, vast majority flips mm-hmm. their answers between the two of those.
Right, right.
And what this basically shows is that we have very different view of discounting now and later. That in the future, we are wonderful people. Mm-hmm. We will wait for another half a box of chocolate. We will exercise. We will eat well. We will have safe sex. We will take our medication on time. We'll be fantastic people. At the moment, we're not that great. We succumb to temptation when we see creme brulee and we mm-hmm. Text and drive and when we see chocolate and all kinds of things like that. So these kind of experiments are actually incredibly reliable because people have the same emotional gut impulses that get them to behave very differently in the here and now mm-hmm. than how they wish they would behave in the long term.
So are you suggesting this is, given that there's very low deviations between, you can get a small sample size, so we're saying, gosh, this is a really ubiquitous sort of trait that in people. Are there any gender or cultural differences that play in this, or do you find, is this a human trait, or is this something that we somehow learned along the way?
Yeah. So depends on which phenomena we're talking about, right? There's one way to be rational, there are many, many ways to be irrational, and there are many irrational forces that play into us. In this particular case, it's emotions. It's the fact that in the here and now, when you see a piece of chocolate, you can feel the emotion. When you see chocolate cake, the waiter can talk to you about chocolate cake, but if they show it to you, you feel very differently. All of a sudden, emotion gets evoked. And that's actually very similar across people. We don't find gender differences. We don't find age differences. We don't find cultural differences. There are other things that we do find differences. But here's kind of my view currently of this. I think that deep down, we're all the same, but we have a cultural veneer on top of that. And what the cultural veneer does is it lets some of our instincts and decisions to express themselves, and sometimes they don't, sometimes not to express themselves. So I think we all have a preference for the here and now versus the later. For example, in financial decision-making, we prefer to buy something now than to save for later. But some culture have developed rules about how much you should save and how you should save and how you should consider discretionary income. And those rules basically operate as a veneer on top of that. If you took the same person and you didn't give them those rules, they would behave all the same. But the rule kind of creates a meta layer that gets this behavior not to be expressed.
So there's a biological hardwiring is kind of what you're exposing at some level, right? So that, yes, there's a veneer that goes on top of it. So if we think about how this sort of translates into the world that we see around us, I find that the larger and more distant and more nebulous a threat is, no matter how gigantic that threat is, I find that people engage with it less. We find less leadership around it. We find less discussion. But the closer and more immediate it is, you know, if the saber-toothed tiger's in the room, we pay a lot of attention to it. But if we're, you know, rainfall might shift in 10 years, we're going to pay a lot less attention to it. Is this just a function of biology? Is this how we're wired up? Is this?
Yeah. So there's something we call the identifiable victim effect that plays very well into this idea. And this was the only thing that Mother Teresa and Joseph Stalin agreed on. And Mother Teresa at some point said, "If I look at the masses, I will never act. If I look at the one, I will." And Joseph Stalin said, "A million deaths is a statistics. One death is a tragedy." She said opposite. But And the notion here is that what gets us to act and to care is not statistical mathematical computation of cost and benefit. It's emotions. And emotions, sadly, get evoked when we see an immediate problem of somebody who is next to us. And they don't get evoked when we see problems of many people far away in a distance, either physical distance or temporal distance. Here's a way to think about it. Imagine you're going for an interview. It's your dream job. You have a new suit and new shoes and new underwear. Everything is fantastic. You spend over $1,000 on this suit. And you're over one of the bridges between Boston and Cambridge, and you're walking toward this interview, and you don't have time to spare, and all of a sudden you hear a cry of a girl. And you look down, and there's a little girl that is about to drown in the river. And you have no time to take your clothes off. If you want to save her, you have to jump. And if you jump, you'll save her. And if you don't, she'll die, most likely. But if you jump to save her, you'll lose your job. There's no way you'll make it to the job interview. Mm-hmm. So you're risking, really, not only your suit and all this new stuff, but also your wonderful career that you were hoping to get. And you ask people, would you do it? And most people say, I don't think I could imagine even doing this trade-off, right? You see the girl drowning, you would just jump immediately without thinking. And then you say, what about giving kids in Africa who are drowning in a sense from malaria and starvation and other things, not $1,000, not your future career, what about giving them $15 a month? And people just don't care to the same degree. And actually, the sad thing is that if you think about something like global warming, it's the worst problem from a human motivation perspective. In fact, if you went backward and you said, let's create a problem that people would not care about, it would look like global warming. It has all the elements for human apathy. Long-term in the future, not certain, will happen to other people first. We don't see anybody now suffering. We don't see it progressing. And anything we could do is a drop in the bucket. Right?
There's no face to attach to this. Who can we blame?
That's right. So because of that, we just don't care. We just don't care. And by the way, I think that the approach, so From my perspective, the approach is, you can say, can we get people to care? And I think the answer is basically no. Can I give you kind of a slightly R-rated analogy for this?
Sure.
So, you know, it's very hard to convince men to wear condoms to prevent AIDS. Again, AIDS, it's STD, it's long-term in the future. The chances of getting AIDS from vaginal intercourse is not that high. It's about, you know, 1 in 200. Very hard to convince men to wear condom. There's about 2% of men who have a latex fetish. They love latex. And those guys are really easy to convince to wear condoms for obvious reasons, right? They love latex. I think the same thing is about works for global warming. There's going to be about 2% of the people who are going to really care. They're going to wake up energized every morning about taking care of global warming. And the rest of the people, the masses that we would really like to switch their behavior, are just not going to care. So now, if you take this as a starting point, that people are just not designed to care about something like global warming, you need to think about other solutions. You have to say to yourself, education is just not going to work here. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is to develop different approaches. We need to get people to behave as if they care. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually a really interesting idea. So we, for example, have an infinite capacity to care about our egos. I mean, we do lots of stuff for our egos. Can you make it so that being good for the environment will be something that would reward our egos? Right? What happened if your Facebook page had an indication of how much energy you're using? Mm-hmm. Right? All of a sudden, it would involve your ego. What would happen if the car that you used indicated something about your ego? I think this is why the Prius has been so successful, for example. So this idea we basically call reward substitution. We say if people are not designed to care about the real thing, maybe we can substitute with something else. And by people worrying about this other thing, they will behave as if they care about the environment, or they behave as if they care about something else. And I think those are kind of some of the approaches we need to work on. Now, the same thing happens with politicians. You know, you can think, can politicians really care about something that their voters don't care about, and they don't care also about as individuals? You know, Paul Slovic have said, you know, every time there's a genocide, people get together afterward and say, never again. And how often have we said that, never again? But at a time when genocide happens, and it wasn't so long ago that we had lots of genocides. When it happens, people just don't seem to care that much. Right? Afterward, I mean, you know, there's a movie about it, an HBO, and we feel sorry about it and so on. But at the time, we don't seem to be dragged into actions. And I think that what we need is, we need kind of rules of engagement. We need to understand that what motivates us to act is not our thinking capacity, it's our hearts. And our hearts are not always going to be called into action. For example, in Rwanda, it was a story about that escaped about one person that we got the full description of their misery that got people to care about it. Or in a very different case, in Britain, they were slaughtering all the cows because of the mad cow disease, until I think the Sunday Times published a picture of a young calf. And, you know, young calf, unlike old cows, is kind of cute, and people were outraged, and they stopped it. If they took a picture of hundreds of thousands of them, nobody would have cared, but it was the picture of the individual that made a difference. So I think we can't let chance dictate whether there will be pictures of this event. And we actually need to create rules about what are we going to care about. Mm-hmm. And we need to create those in advance and create a strategy of what we're going to do. What kind of life and strategy and plan do we want to have? Because unless we create that, we will just act for things randomly, depending on whether we have a picture of an identifiable victim or not. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, will be a terrible situation.
You know, there was a real learning for me. It was about a year ago, maybe less, where a freighter was caught in a storm, and they got the crew off. But right when they pulled the last crew guy off, his little dog ran away.
That's right. I remember
and there was
story.
This big international outcry, and people donated, I think, $300,000 to mount not one but two separate Coast Guard rescue missions, helicopter, whole nine yards, for one dog.
Yeah.
And this is at the same time that there's all kinds of things going on in Iraq, which had arguably far more misery associated with it. But so you're saying this connection is that somehow it's because it's a one dog and people could put themselves into a frame of reference to think about a lonely dog shivering on a big empty ship, and they project through all of that. So this is where the care comes from, right?
That's right. That's exactly it. I remember the story. And again, it was crazy. I mean, you can think about Iraq, but you can think about lots of other stuff,
right? Oh, sure.
Yeah. Immunizations. I mean, here's the problem. Anything that has to do with prevention inherently doesn't have a face, because it hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the things we react to is when we see suffering in action. Right? What about all the suffering that we can prevent about the future? It doesn't have a face. We just don't care about it as much. So, you know, Exxon Valdez, terrible accident.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember exactly the numbers, but I think that something like recovering a seal was around $300,000 and a seagull was around $60,000. I mean, the numbers were really very, very big.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrible what we did to them. It's terrible what we did to these animals. But it's also quite terrible of what we're doing to, you know, the 2 million kids on the streets in the U.S. I mean, there's lots of things, ways in which you could use money to better off the globe. It's not clear that we're always using it the right way.
So in these emotions that then motivate it, which ones are, have you mapped them out so you know which ones are more important? Is there a hierarchy here? Is fear a better motivator than guilt or shame? Or
so, you know, I'm Jewish, so I have to say that
guilt
very good.
Very much. It's a very powerful emotion, I understand.
So, you know, I think that I don't think it's that simple. Because I think that as an empirical person, I would like to say that we should try which emotion works best in each situation. But in general, if you think about positive versus negative emotions, we usually think that negative emotions work better. But they have to have a path of action. If I just make you feel bad, but I don't tell you what you can do to make this feeling go away, it's not going to be helpful. But negative feelings are much more intense. We have much more capacity. You know, I've done lots of research on pain and pleasure over the year. I started my career in research as doing research on pain, actually. I was a burn patient. I was in hospital for a long time, and my first interest in irrationality came from the debates I used to have with the nurses about how to remove my bandages, to remove them quickly or slowly. You know, high pain for short time or lower pain for much longer time. And it turns out the nurses had a theory that the ripping approach was better. I personally think they got it because they were mostly women, and I think they used kind of the way that they waxed their legs as a theory of how you should remove bandages from burn patients. But they thought that the ripping approach was the right one. I didn't feel that was the right one. And when I got out of hospital, I started doing experiments and showed that this was not the right approach, that the slow approach creates much less pain than the one they were using. But, you know, the truth is that we have an incredible capacity for pain, and we're not that much pleasure machine. It's kind of a sad observation, but think about it. How could you get people to experience pleasure? Experimentally, what would you do?
You could give them some reward.
Like what?
I don't think it could be money. It could be some food reward. Yep. It could be
money, food, sex, right? I mean, those are kind of the three things. And at least food and sex have diminishing returns. I mean, you can't have, there's a limit to how much you can have. At some point, it will be aversive.
Mm-hmm.
It will be negative. Pain, much easier to think about, right? I can hurt you with pressure, temperature, electrical shock. I mean, there's lots and lots of ways to hurt you. Light, sounds. I mean, just
you can
just
administer it in precise doses and ratchet it up and all of that.
Yeah, cayenne pepper. I mean, there's just lots of ways to do. We're much more, we have a tremendous capacity for pain. And none of those pains, by the way, have diminishing returns. Electrical shock, right? At no point will it become reversed.
Habituated, right? <Yes. laughs> Like, oh, that feels well right now.
So I think that in general, negative rewards are more powerful than positive ones, sadly. But you do have not just to punish, but to show the path of how to eliminate that negative reward.
So can you talk to me about the high price of ownership? I want to connect this to what's going on out there in the world right now.
So ownership is kind of interesting. The moment we own something, we start valuing it more. And it can be something we bought, something we got, something we created. It can even be an idea. At the moment you have an idea, you think your idea is more valuable than other people's idea just because you came up with it. And not only do we overvalue it, we're blind to the fact that we're overvaluing it. We don't understand that other people would not see it in the same way that we see it. So you either build something or own something or think about something, and I ask you, how much is it? How much do you value it? And you give me a high number, and I said, how much do you think it will be valued in the market? And you also mistakenly think that other people would value it as mm-hmm. much as you do.
So this high price of ownership, like we just came through this housing bubble, yeah. right? Which I assume has all sorts of factors at play in this thing. We had yeah. greed, everybody else is doing it, there's conformity, there's peer pressure, there's this high price of ownership, right?
Yeah.
I paid $600,000 for this house, it must be worth at least that, right?
So it's not just that, but housing is kind of a unique case because not only do you buy it, but most people change something about the house. Mm. So at an early stage, there was a study that Zillow was doing about how people view the value of their house. And what they found out is that people realized that people in their neighborhoods were selling houses for much less, but they did not think it affected their own value of the home. And right. the question is why? And the reason is that, you know, I look at your house, let's say we bought the same house, basically, in the same neighborhood, very similar, and then I look at your house and you sold it for $100,000 less than what you bought it for. But I look at this and I said, of course, because, you know, your kitchen was this terrible color and you didn't break the wall to the bathroom like I did, and you didn't do the skylight and you didn't paint it in a beautiful purple like I do. And basically, because we tailor the house to the exact preferences of things that we like, and because we don't understand that other people might not like it, we think that our house is not impacted the same way that other houses.
So I think I've seen the studies, right, where Zillow asked people and they said, how many of you think houses are going up in general next year? And it'd be 35%, right? And then they say, how many people think that your house specifically is going up? And it was like 80%.
Right? That's right. So there's, of course, optimism bias too. But part of it is that people just view their homes as much more special and unique and important and valuable and so on. And I have to say, I made the same mistake. So when Sumi and I moved to Cambridge, we bought this old house and we fixed it. And we took a house that was, you know, from 1880 on the outside, and the inside we made it very modern and interesting, what we thought was interesting. And when we tried to sell it, when we moved to North Carolina, lots of people came and lots of people were very impressed with the house, but nobody wanted to live there.
Yep.
And it was heartbreaking, but we had to undo some of the changes we made, make it into a much more boring house, and then we sold it.
Hmm. So I'm really interested in the work you do, and what I'm what I'd really like to find out is your views of this crisis we've just come through. So let me give you part of my bias. The thing starts cracking in about August 2007. By 2008, it's obvious to everybody that something is really up. 2009, we're in the depths of it. Here we are coming at the end of 2010, and I've already heard lots of comments from people saying, whew, that was close, it's over, and you know, dodged a real bullet, we're back on the path. And my opinion of this is that, my assessment is that I think some people are ready to go back to the same behaviors that we were just going through. That I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective, A, how did we get into this? B, what does it take for real learning to set in? Or in your assessment now, and you can speculate wildly, you know, have lessons been learned or not? Or what would it take to actually, through behavioral economics, how would we cement learning so that actually a crisis wouldn't go to waste, in essence?
So I think the people who are ready to move forward are the people who are making fantastic amounts of money in the market. Mm-hmm. So here's kind of my view of the causes. I think it's all about conflicts of interest. And I think the housing bubble was incidental. It could have been something else, and it will be something else next time. Imagine that I paid you $5 million a year to view mortgage-backed securities as a good product. Don't you think you will be able to do it? And the answer is, of course you would. And I don't mean, wouldn't you be able to cheat and say that you believe it? I think, don't you really believe that you would be able to see it slightly differently? And the answer is absolutely yes. And that's the power of conflicts of interest. And you know, we see it in sports. You and I kind of are fan of the same team. You know, if a referee calls a call against our team, we think the referee is evil, vicious, blind, you know, something bad. And in sports, it's great, right? It makes maybe the sports more interesting and exciting. But the problem with conflict of interest is that people don't see how they're being colored by their financial incentives. They just don't see it. On top of that, it turns out that when you have conflicts of interest with something that is multiple steps removed from money, it's not about money, it's about something different. Think about stocks, stock options, mortgage-backed security, things that are complex and difficult, where you sit with your big Excel spreadsheet with lots of assumptions and computations and parameters. And if you choose 4.2 as you expected return, it will be slightly worse for you than if you choose 4.1. And the question is, wouldn't you be able to play with those parameters a little bit to get the results more in the way you wanted? And I think that was basically the problem, that we got to pay people lots and lots of money to see reality in a distorted way, and then we were surprised that they saw it in a distorted way. And by the way, they still see it in a distorted way. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me, in some sense, how people on Wall Street basically think that the world is just the same as it used to be.
I think your 2% that you gave before, that like 2% of the people would be able to, yeah. I think that's about how many people saw this coming. Right now 90% of the people saw this coming. Everybody saw it. But at the time, it was actually fairly lonely territory, because I was in there. And there's a few representatives here, right? There are people who made fantastic amounts of money seeing it. But it seems like that's a really rare thing when the whole herd is going this direction.
Yeah.
Very few people are on the edges.
Yeah, I can't imagine it was even 2% in this case. I think it was much more rare to see it. And of course, you know, there's some people who always bet against the trend, so you have to take those people out. But the problem, the real problem I see is that we haven't really changed anything about the conflicts of interest in banking, and because of that, we'll have another crisis. I mean, look, how healthy can it be in principle? If you have an industry that basically take 70-60% of their income and distribute it as bonuses or salaries, right? It's a really expensive industry, and now they have to somehow maintain it. And people got used to living on very high salaries, and they very quickly are able to justify it. We are fantastic justifying machines. Imagine that your salary tomorrow got multiplied 50 times. How long will it take you to feel that you really deserve it?
About 10 minutes.
That's right. By the way, here's the thing that always puzzled me about Wall Street or banking. Imagine an industry that is perfect commodity with lots and lots of competition. What should the margins of profit be in that industry?
Very low.
Very low.
Just above the risk-free rate of
that's right.
Or something.
And now ask yourself, isn't banking exactly that? Lots of competition, basically commodity.
Everybody would love to work in it, so they can't have a labor shortage.
That's right. And how can it be that they have such high margins of profit? In fact, it's a conundrum, right? Because if there would be any industry that you would expect to be a commodity with perfect competition, it will be banking. And I mean, because how long will it take you to switch from one to the other? It's a matter of seconds.
And this is a relatively new thing. I've got the memoirs of my great-great-grandfather. He started a bank, and my great-grandfather served on the bank, and he tried to very, very hard dissuade my grandfather from also serving in the bank, because who would want to go into it? He said, the pay is horrible. You know, there's really, we're not going to get much out of this, and there's a lot of risk, and your capital's exposed. And my grandfather's memoirs was his father really trying hard to get him not to go into banking. Horrible. Uh-huh. And that was in the 40s.
Yeah.
Right? So something's shifted between here and there. Something really dramatic.
Yeah. And you know, I'm not a historian of banking, but I think people discovered investment and speculation, and then we found ways to channel lots and lots of money to this market. So I think that, you know, aside from the bailouts, 401k money is being pouring into the market. And what are you going to do with it, right? If you're sitting there on a pile of money that every month you get more and more of it because you're running some big fund for some retirement pension, you have to invest. Mm-hmm. Something has to do. So there's money just pouring in because of the 401k, because we've basically stopped pensions and we gave people this responsibility to save for themselves. And we told people to start saving in the stock market. So that's what everybody's doing. So something has to happen. And I think because of that, we don't see the reality.
And there was moral hazard got injected here. So 1998... long-term capital management goes belly up, and it was a relic by today's standards. It was nothing.
Yes.
It was a $4 billion hiccup, right? But so Greenspan rides to the rescue and basically says, we're not going to let this go down, systemic risk. And Wall Street looked at that and said, ah, so this means if we do really big bets, you've got to put, right? You're gonna be there to ride to the rescue. So in my mind, that was one inflection point. We were already on a slope, but that really dialed it up at that moment.
You know, I don't know if people were that thoughtful about it. The truth is that the people I know on Wall Street, I think, had no idea what risks that they were taking. I don't think that they actually believed that they were taking big risks and there was any chance in the world that they would need to be bailed out. And, you know, I also have some very sad stories about people who were taking big risks and putting all their companies in, all their money in Bear Stearns. I mean, people who were working there really believed somehow that the company was doing amazingly well. Mm-hmm. Somebody told me that when he heard the report that they were failing, he thought that the reporter was just crazy. And he was a very high senior in that bank.
Yeah.
So I think part of it was, you know, wishful blindness, really lack of desire to see reality. I mean, they were getting paid so much money. They were thinking that the masses of the universe, inventing all kinds of things. There were these complex models running behind it that most people don't really understand what's going on. And they were feeling, I think, very quickly they came to believe that they were actually doing something useful for the world and for themselves. You know, the new knights of capitalism, and truly believed somehow they were not taking lots of risks.
But that self-deception, from what you said earlier, is much easier to do if you're being paid just giant loads of money.
Yes,
because
yes.
After all, a man who's paid as much as I am, how could he be wrong? Right? So there's layers to this self-deception. Everybody else is doing it.
Actually, everybody else doing it is also very, very powerful, right? So they were surrounded by other people who have the same incentives. And those kind of valuations, when you value something and I value something, can ratchet a little bit even more extremely if we all believe in the same way, kind of groupthink, basically. So we saw lots and lots of bad behavior. And going back to your question, you know, have we done anything? The sad thing is not really, right? The truth is that we have to deal with salaries on Wall Street. There's no way around it, right? You can't pay people bonuses that are contingent on them taking short-term risk and expect them not to do that. It's just not going to work. And you can't expect the employers to regulate their employees' behavior. We just can't do it. And the example I give is that imagine you can go in front of a judge who would get paid by a percentage of the verdict. They would get 5% of the verdict that they pass on you. Would you want to go in front of this judge? And everybody said, of course not. It's crazy. Why would I want to do it? They would give me a very high... Why are we willing to pay our bankers this way? Why are we willing to pay our physicians this way? I think we have to understand that this is terrible incentive structure. And if we put good people, you know, you and I think of ourselves as honorable, wonderful people who care about other people and would do a lot to help other people, I don't think we would have been very different. Right, we would put in that situation and get this amazing incentive to see reality in a different way. I'm kind of sure we would be able to do that.
And I can guarantee you, even if I was in that situation and I saw that this was a game of musical chairs, I would have played as hard and as fast as I could, I'm sure, because think of the rewards you're getting. And the game might stop sooner or later, but if I can earn several million dollars in this.
But I think it's not just playing. I think you would really get yourself to believe that this is the case. Because
it's an important point.
Because if you were just playing it, I could say, okay, let's just get people who care more or people who are not interested in the game. I think you and I would really believe that we're doing the right thing. And that's kind of the tricky thing. Our capacity to rationalize is really amazing.
So people are rationalizers, not rational. And I think you've answered one of the most important questions. So here's one of the most important questions that people chew on all the time in our universe. Are we going to face inflation or deflation? Right? As if it's some sort of a force of nature that will sweep through. But in fact, it's actually largely under our control because we can print money out of thin air.
As we've seen.
As fast as we want. At no cost, right? Instantaneously. How many zeros do you want, sir?
Yeah.
So Reinhardt and Rogoff did this beautiful study of 800 years of economic history and said, wow, all the times countries ever got into debt trouble, they never went down the default path. They would always go down the inflation, if not hyperinflation path, because from what you've been talking about before, hyperinflation is a future pain. Deflation is an immediate pain.
Yeah.
Right? So you've given me more context for understanding like the rationale for why it is that given a choice. And it's not like people sitting down and going, you know, I'll take the hyperinflation later for $1,000. You know, they're not making that decision. What they're saying is, oh, if I go down the deflation path, people will be out of work today.
Yep.
People are going to yell at me today. My salary will go down today. I will get voted out of office today. So it's just an immediacy issue, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, does that fit?
Yeah, very much. And the same thing goes about getting debt and, paying in the future. Paying in the future is much easier. And, you know, in some sense, we all do it. Right? I get invited to lots of places to give lectures. And if somebody asks me to go next month, I know I can't do it. Mm-hmm. But if you ask me in a year, I think, oh, my goodness, I'm perfectly free.
Sure.
Nothing but time.
Yeah.
So the future looks much brighter than the present, and we're willing, because of that, we're doing lots of things, lots of terrible things to ourselves.
Well, fantastic. I'd like to give you an opportunity to call this to a close now if you want. You've been very generous with your time, but I could talk about this all night personally.
Very good. No, so I actually had a long day, but this was fun, so thank you very much.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
Very good.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartenson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.